Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, it's a Wednesday, and that means we turn to the outdoors and the environment. And today, we take a look at waterfowl conservation and hunting as well on the show with a couple of guests. One of them, Brad Heidel, the other, Taylor Finger. Brad is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association. Brad, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. Looking forward to it. We got a lot of really neat things to talk about this hour.
I believe we do. Taylor Taylor Finger is a game bird ecologist at the Wisconsin DNR. Taylor, good to have you back with us as well. Thanks for joining in.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Well, as we talk with them, we want to hear from you. Maybe you could share how you're involved in some local conservation efforts. And maybe you can talk about duck hunting or goose hunting with us. How are you getting the next generation educated and interested maybe in waterfowl hunting opportunities? Give a call. The number, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Brad, maybe we can start with you talking about the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association. What's the goal of that group?
Well, the goal of the group is threefold, actually. First is obviously going to be habitat conservation, wetland restoration, et cetera, you know, so we can put more habitat on the ground so we can breed more ducks in the state of Wisconsin for duck hunters. And then another pillar is going to be our education side, which is going to be our R3 component, which is going to be the recruitment, reactivation, and help me out here, Taylor.
Retention.
Recruitment, reactivation, and
retention.
Retention. And retention of our waterfowl hunters. And then the last part of the organization, the third, is going to be the advocacy work for roughly the 58,000 duck hunters in the state of Wisconsin.
Taylor, let me turn to you for a second. Are you a hunter? Is that how you got involved with the DNR in the first place, maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. Born and raised. I was helping carry my dad's decoys before I could actually shoot. So I ended up getting a pretty solid job.
Yeah, that's for sure. Although, you know, I've interviewed probably hundreds of DNR folks over the years, and they said they got involved in fishing or hunting, and then they wind up having to work during the busiest times of the year when they'd like to be out doing it themselves. They're actually helping DNR with whatever tasks that are needed during the season.
Yeah, the nice thing about it with duck hunting is most of the duck hunters are pretty happy when the season's going on, so the work kind of slows down when the hunting season's going on afterwards and when it starts picking up.
Brad, how did you get started in waterfowl hunting?
You know, probably the same way a lot of other folks did, and that would be through family. I still hunt with my brothers. My grandpa got us out. We started out hunting on Lake Puckaway and Green Lake growing up. Back in the day, you could start hunting at the age of 12, and we all started at that time.
Yeah, it's cool. And one of the things that strikes me about the association is the interest in wildlife and habitat management. And maybe you could talk a little more about what you're doing to teach wildlife and habitat management, Brad.
You know, a lot of that's probably done through our Learn to Hunt programs, which we do hand-in-hand with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And part of those courses is to actually teach them about the habitat itself before actually getting out into the field and then showing them what that habitat looks like. So that's been very successful for us because it gives them an opportunity to learn about wetland conservation, while at the same time getting them out in the field.
Yeah, it makes sense. And Taylor, waterfowl are coming through Wisconsin right now after traveling, from other states and from Canada. How does the DNR work with other agencies to keep tabs on waterfowl?
Yeah, so we partner a lot with, you know, our universities. We partner. I have a meeting later today with the Mississippi Flyway technical section, where it's all 14 states and three Canadian provinces, everyone in my position. And we are going to be talking and discussing about exactly what's going on. Hunting seasons are ramping up, you know, for the northern states. The southern states haven't started yet. And we'll be discussing how migration's occurring, what's it's looking like up in Manitoba and Saskatchewan, and in terms of what we should be expecting for fall migration.
Why is it so important to survey and keep an eye on populations?
It's critical when it comes to, you know, any game species, because you are, you know, targeting and hunting these birds, and so you're removing them. So it is our responsibility as well to ensure that we're monitoring that what we're doing in terms of harvest is actually management, and so we're not negatively affecting the resource.
And maybe you could talk a bit more about the waterfowl breeding population survey. How do you take air and land observations in order to count the birds?
Yeah, so I'm fortunate, you know, one of those ones where, and when work, it actually isn't work, is I get to get up in the plane. And yeah, we fly 66 30 mile transects all across the state, starting, you know, all the way down by Rock and Green County and ending up in Lake Superior. And yeah, we fly about 150 to 200 feet up in the air at about 100 miles an hour, and we're counting ducks. And so again, it's a good time, but that's really the important part, is to get an idea during the springtime of what birds are around at a time when we're expecting those birds to be breeding, just to give us some type of metric or index of what the population's going to look like.
And you put people out, men and women out in the field walking those streams too.
Yeah, because we can't count everything. As much as I'd love to say that I counted every single bird as I was going by at 100 miles an hour, I can't necessarily say that that's the case. So what we do is we'll fly it, and then within the next 24 hours, we have a ground crew that goes along the same transect that we flew to and make sure that they saw similar birds. And if they counted more, we just develop a correction factor for it.
Email from Rita, and Brad, maybe you can take this one. What's the difference between hunting geese and hunting ducks?
They're bigger. That's the simple answer. It's easier to hit a goose than it is a little duck. But, you know, it really varies, especially in the state of Wisconsin. You know, a lot of people are probably primarily hunting geese on dry land within our state, where you're going to see the vast majority of the people that are hunting ducks typically concentrate on water areas.
Yeah, I think that's pretty true. Horicon Marsh area gets, and I've spent a lot of time in hunting geese myself in that particular area, whereas ducks, I spent more time on Door Creek and other spots that were local for me, where we could do a little jump shooting or pass shooting of them. Gary and Kenan has a question. Let's go there. Gary, hi.
Yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with Steve Creek Flowage. It's on Taylor County and Price County line. And the control structure on the one in Price County, the lower flowage, blew out several years ago. And I was wondering if you knew anything, if is going to be repaired on that, because now it's just like a creek.
Taylor? Yeah, go ahead, Taylor.
Yeah, I'll touch base with the biologist up in Price County. It's one of those ones where we have a infrastructure, essentially, analysis that we had to go through. We have, if you add up the entire mileage of dikes that we have in the state of Wisconsin, it goes all the way from Minneapolis to Milwaukee. So we have, you know, hundreds of miles of dikes and impoundments and structures and things like that we have to go through. So I would have to double check to see if that one made the list, but just recognizing that the vast majority of our wetland infrastructure was developed in the 50s and 60s, and a lot of them are failing right now. And so, yeah, just trying to find enough money and enough staff time to get every single one of those is difficult. So okay. I'll just touch base.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Gary. Phil in Mount Horeb, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm not a wildfowl hunter, but I am a hunter, and I've always been curious to know, and I'm sure lots of your listeners would be too, Just how well are you able to identify a wildfowl by species when, you know, it's dusky out there and cloudy and hard to see?
Yeah, well, I think both of our guests could take a crack at that. Brad, start with you.
Yeah, well, I'm going to start out with, you know, the experienced duck hunter, someone who's been out there waterfowl hunting for some time, and I'm talking about ducks in particular. You learn that over time, and you go through a period where you're mentored by other hunters who help to help you learn how to distinguish different species on the wing. And it's once you've done it for a couple of years, it's really quite simple. I would say when you start looking at the bigger species like Canada geese, for instance, it's really quite simple to tell the difference between a Canada goose and a snow goose or a speckle belly.
Yeah. Taylor, to add to that.
Yeah, spending time in the marsh. That's really what you need to do is you have to put yourself in those situations where you're like, oh, yep, that was, you know, if you see a flock of 15 or 20 ducks that are, you know, buzzing through, that's likely going to be teal. You know, even if it is too dark to necessarily see exactly what their wings look like or the shape of their flight, and quite frankly, if you don't know, don't pull the trigger. That's something that we really emphasize with a lot of our hunters out there is, you know, I'd much rather not pull the trigger and still have a good experience than pull it, and then all of a sudden you're trying to scramble to figure out what you should be doing.
Yeah. And why is it so important that we identify each of these when it comes to ducks? Because it is important.
Yeah, again, we have federal regulations. Waterfowl are, you know, federally regulated because they fall under the Migratory Bird Treaty. And so for most of our species, we do have a bag limit specific to them as it relates to how many we count in the springtime. We also know what our harvest rates are on these birds because we ban them. And so the bag limit is to ensure that we don't over-harvest or impact the population negatively through hunting.
I just have a quick question for you, Taylor. My recollection is that in all reality, hunters really only have probably 4% or less of an effect on the overall population of waterfowl. Is that
about right,
yeah.
Taylor?
Yeah, under our current adaptive harvest management, so under, you know, our regulations of 60-day seasons and the bag limits, yeah, at the harvest that we currently are occurring, yeah, we have very little impact whatsoever on the majority of our species. There's certainly species out there under the sea duck guild or, you know, canvasbacks or some other things that we need to be careful on. But for the vast majority of the waterfowl out there under our current harvest frameworks, yeah, we're not negatively affecting the populations at all.
Phil, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too with a question or comment. The number 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. Talking with Brad Heidel, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, and Taylor Finger, Game Bird Ecologist at the Wisconsin DNR. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Taking a look at hunting and waterfowl today on the program, and we can take other hunting questions as well with our two guests today, Brad Heidel, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, Taylor Finger, Game Bird Ecologist at the Wisconsin DNR. Great to have both of them with us. You know, it reminds me, we're talking about identifying, it reminded me about numbers. Tell us the results of this year's breed population survey, if you could, Taylor. Are numbers increasing, decreasing, staying the same?
Yeah, across, so for spring of 25, we were up about 7% from 2024 with about 565,000 birds. So again, generally it was pretty good. Our mallard counts were up a little bit. Our wood ducks were essentially exactly the same as what we had been seeing. Our Canada geese were down a little bit and our teal were down about 15%. But our other ducks made up a huge chunk of it because we've been flying that survey earlier and earlier because we haven't had much of a winter lately.
Yeah. You mentioned mallards, and that's one species that's important to look at. what do the mallard population levels tell you about how other species of ducks are doing?
Yeah, mallards are kind of one of those focal species that we use as a good indicator of what other, you know, ducks that breed in grassland habitat are doing. So we actually use that at the federal end in terms of we monitor mallards. We actually use mallards as our species to look at how they're doing compared to wetlands. And then that is used to set, you know, the season length. It's used to set a lot of the other bag limits just because if they're doing well, and they're the highest harvested species that we have out there. So if they're doing well or they're doing poorly, it's usually a good indicator of what other ducks are doing as well.
Hmm. Ron in Land O'Lakes has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I'd just like to mention, I'm new to hunting, my son and I, and we just happened to attend the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association Learn to Hunt program this past weekend in Pulaski. And Brad, I believe I met you there. We were able to go out with two mentors out on the bay, and we had an awesome experience. So it was a great experience that the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association put on. So I just like to say thank you and a shout out to them.
Ron, thanks for calling. Brad, comment.
Absolutely. That's so exciting. Ron, yes, we did meet, and I knew you were going to have a wonderful hunt. They got to get out on Green Bay in a big old boat and chase literally divers out there, diver ducks. And so I know you guys had a wonderful time, and I'm so glad it worked out well for you. It's really a neat program that we do with the Wisconsin DNR to get not just, let's just call them children outdoors, but we want to get young adults and adults out as well, because those folks have a real opportunity to move the needle in the hunting world.
Yeah.
So glad you had a great time. Awesome to hear.
What's the usual approach, or what steps to happen during one of those classes?
If Ron's still on, I'd let him answer that question. If not, I'm happy to.
Go ahead. I'm not sure Ron is still there.
All right, then. So we really spend a couple days with the folks, and we first take them through what's really the most important thing, and that's going to be safety. And we want to make sure that they are fully aware of their surroundings and how to handle a firearm before we take them out. So that evening, we'll take them out. We'll talk to them about firearm safety. We'll talk about hunting safety. We talk about the Tab K, which is everyone who's went through Hunter's Ed knows what that means. And then we take them through a full hour of identification, and then we actually get them out on the range and take them out trap shooting and put them in, you know, real life scenario. So if the next day they're going to be hunting in a field in a layout blind, we'll have them shooting from a layout blind. If they're going to be shooting from a boat, we'll have them shooting from a boat. And then that next morning we got up at, I said, what time are you guys picking me up? And they said, we'll be at your place at 2:30. So they picked us up 2:30 in the morning, and we got out in the marsh. We were not set up, but we were out there with our boats by 3:00. And you can set up your decoys an hour ahead of time, so we got that done. And then everybody had an opportunity at birds that day, so they get the full experience.
Yeah.
Then they come back, we show them how to clean them, and then we cook them up for them.
Sounds like a good deal to me. Taylor, and you guys work hand in glove with that association and other groups as well. I took my daughter, Emily, through the hunter safety program. She wanted to go with me hunting turkeys.
Yeah, we do a lot of learn to hunt for turkeys, learn to hunt for pheasants, learn to hunt for deer, learn to trap. We do a ton. One of the new ones that we've been working with Wisconsin Wildlife Federation and Ducks Unlimited on is that we also have a program, work with WWA as well on this, is that we have a similar situation that Brad identified, but for wildlife professionals. Because there's a growing percentage of our wildlife professionals, you know, biologists and technicians and researchers that are coming out of, you know, college or university that have never hunted before. And so we've actually ramped up this program as well to get them out and experience what it is. You know, it's a combination of some of the hunting experience, but also where does the money come from for your habitat work that you're going to be doing? Or, you know, how do you talk to a hunter that's angry, or managing those types of situations from a professional level as well? So, yeah, we try to run the gambit.
And where the money comes reminds me of licenses and stamps. And we might take a minute on that. I buy from the DNR a patron's license. And that is sort of the ultimate license, I guess, because it covers pretty much everything. I don't use it for everything. I mostly do it as a donation, in a way, to the DNR. But maybe spend a minute or two, let's spend a minute or two on licenses and kind of what's needed and stamps and why they're important.
Yeah. So in order to waterfowl hunt, you're going to need your small game license, and then you have to be, so there's HIP registration. So that's HIP certification. It's a federal requirement. It doesn't cost anything, but that's how the Fish and Wildlife Service will be able to survey you in order to get an accurate representation of what harvest looks like. So you got your small game, your HIP. If you're going to goose hunt, you got to get your earlier, your regular goose permit, and then your state waterfowl stamp and the federal waterfowl stamp. So those, it seems like it's a pocket full of things to get, but the nice thing with the state and the federal waterfowl stamp is 98 cents out of every dollar is going directly back into habitat, whether that's on federal wildlife refuges or our state stamp. You know, one third goes to Canada to help manage habitat up in Canada because they produce a ton of birds for us. And by law, two thirds of it stays directly here and goes right back into habitat management.
Yeah, and Brad, maybe you could comment on that as well, the importance of that.
Yeah, you know, it really makes a difference because that's how the vast majority of the funding comes to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, is through license sales and stamps. So without hunters, our department would have to be getting money elsewhere.
And so, and when you buy a stamp for turkeys, or you buy a stamp for some, you know, let's take an individual stamp, like maybe turkey. Where does the money's going right back to the state here, is it not?
Yep. Yeah. So we have a committee, a turkey advisory committee, a migratory advisory committee, and we get that pool of money, and once every 2 years we'll sit down and we get, you know, projects from internal partner or from our internal staff. We get projects that come from our external partners, and we sit down as a committee, and our role and responsibility is to review every single one of those projects and say, okay, we can fund this one with the money that we have. And, you know, kind of as Brad highlighted, we generally have 2 to 3 times more projects than we can actually fund, just because, you know, our revenue source is not high enough to fund everything that comes across our table.
And the DNR is also banding birds. My daughter had an internship with the DNR a couple of summers ago, and it was a stream project where she was shocking fish and taking water samples. But there was a time there when they said, "Hey, do you want to come over and help with some banding of geese?" And she said that was probably the most fun day that she had, you know, in the summer when they were molting and the geese couldn't fly. What's the purpose of banding?
Yeah, so historically, the purpose of banding waterfowl was to try to get an idea of where are the birds that we have here going and getting harvested. However, we got technology now that we can put a GPS backpack transmitter on these birds, and we can know where they are every minute of the day for, you know, 2 or 3 years. So we don't have to use banding for that. What we use banding now for is to look at harvest rates and how, you know, hunting is ultimately impacting, you know, population. So we can say, are females being harvested at a higher rate than males? Are young of the year birds being harvested at a higher rate than adults? And, you know, what's just the general overall take for those things? So it's the ultimate citizen science that we use. It's probably the largest citizen science project that we have out there in terms of wildlife management, using this information to ultimately inform how we set hunting regulations and manage these species.
What are the biggest threats to waterfowl populations? I'll ask you both. Brad, I'll maybe start with you. What do you think are the biggest threats?
I would say that there's two major threats to waterfowl populations right now. And the first, and it's always going to be probably the foremost, is going to be habitat and the loss of habitat. And second, I would have to say that predators are a significant impact on waterfowl, especially on nesting waterfowl in the springtime.
Now, Taylor, what about you?
Yeah, it's going to be habitat is the primary one in terms of, you know, land conversion. It's you can't blame our farmers out there. You know, they're just trying to make a living too. But a lot of land's being tiled. You know, a lot of what was historical grassland habitat is now being turned into agriculture. And so it's tough. And again, I'll let Brad include predators. I'm also going to include climate change. There's a lot of stuff happening with regard to the impacts of climate and, you know, the amount of wetlands that are going to be available. And if those birds don't ultimately have to go all the way as far south as we did, as they historically used to. So that's going to be a factor in the upcoming years for sure.
I'm wondering about bird flu. How has bird flu affected impacted our waterfowl?
Yeah, there's a ton of studies. The Mississippi Flyway is actually funding, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of research that's going into looking at the impact in terms of population level impact. What we know is that waterfowl primarily are regular carriers of avian influenza, and they are probably the culprit in terms of transporting it across the landscape. However, the nice thing is they are very resilient to avian influenza. And so long as, I mean, right now with mallards, I don't think you can kill a mallard with this strain of avian influenza. So they're super resilient. There's other species that we have that, you know, are more susceptible. I think scop and some teal and things along those short, you know, that those ones seem to be a little bit more susceptible, swans. However, we're not seeing die-offs at a level that are going to ultimately impact the population. So, you know, it does look, you know, bad when you see 100 or 200, you know, mallards dying. However, if we got 5 million mallards, you know, estimated on the landscape, it's a drop in the bucket. But that being said, it's something we want to monitor from a scientific perspective as well. What happens if a bird did catch avian influenza? Is it less likely to nest next year? And if that's the case, then ultimately there may be some population level impacts because, you know, you've taken that bird out of, you know, production, and, you know, there could be 5, 6, 7 less birds being produced each year because that bird caught avian influenza the year before. So those are the types of things we're looking into right now.
Cater called but couldn't stay with us. This has to do with grouse, and wondering if grouse populations are falling, and does that have anything to do with avian flu or something else?
Yeah, in terms of grouse, I know we were lower this year in terms of our drumming counts. However, I think we're relatively stable compared to what we've seen over the last handful of years. I know from historical perspective, we are down quite a bit. And again, directly back to habitat, and that we're not cutting down trees. We don't have that young forest habitat that we did 50, 60 years ago. It's just, you know, we have a lot more older growth forest across the landscape, and that's directly impacting the grouse population. As it relates to avian influenza, I don't think we've had a single grouse come in over the last 4 years that tested positive for avian influenza, just because they have to come in contact with typically a migratory bird that would be carrying it, and the likelihood of grouse coming into contact with high concentrations of migratory birds is very low.
Brad, thinking about funding here, I understand that you are really interested in the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund. Maybe for those who don't know, what is it and how does it relate to what we're talking about today?
Yeah, well, thanks for asking. You know, the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund is really been a gem for the state of Wisconsin as far as putting public lands in place for not only hunters but all types of people to use those properties, and it's something that we're really looking forward to getting that renewed, that fund will expire in the spring of 2026, and we don't want to see that go away. I think there's a lot of different things that we can do with that fund. We can not only, you know, possibly purchase new properties, but I think we can also maintain the properties that we have already better than we currently are if we're able to continue with that funding. It's something that's pretty important for the state. No other state has anything like it right now. And the reason we're really excited about Knowles Nelson and renewing that is the fact that every property that does get purchased through that program is open to public hunting. And access is always an issue, no matter where you are in the state or whether you're out of state. You want to be able to access as much public land to be able to hunt, because not everybody has the ability to own private property.
Yeah. Taylor, a comment?
Yeah, no, Brad hit it on the head, is that this is something that we've had. You know, it's historically been one of the amazing programs that we've had, and our partners have been very supportive of it. The public's been very supportive of it. And, you know, if it's is something that, you know, we can get renewed, then that would be absolutely awesome in terms of benefiting everyone, not just hunters and anglers and trappers.
Yeah. Actually, this morning, I got an email from the DNR, this little news release email that kind of represents the kind of thing that goes on. And this was the city of Hurley has applied for a 50% matching grant from the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program. It will assist with purchasing about 30 acres of former railroad corridor connecting the cities of Hurley and Montreal in Iron County. They're going to develop a 2.7-mile walking and biking trail between Hurley and Montreal and will connect to the Iron Bell Trail. And if acquired, the activities will include hiking and biking and snowshoeing and cross-country skiing and birdwatching and wildlife viewing and nature appreciation. So it's one example. You know, this is going to be a fantastic thing. May not happen. You know, it probably wouldn't be happening without the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program, Taylor.
Absolutely. Yep. It's a prime example of, and there's so many other of those types of instances that happen across the state that have taken advantage of that funding source that, you know, has allowed us to, you know, help maintain, protect, preserve areas that historically wouldn't have been then.
Yeah. Talking with Brad Heidel, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, and Taylor Finger, a game bird ecologist at the Wisconsin DNR. We've zeroed in a bit on waterfowl, but we're taking some other questions as well relating to our wildlife. And you can join in. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email, the email talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking with Brad Heidel of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association and Taylor Finger, game bird ecologist at the Wisconsin DNR. Again, questions, give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Jack in Appleton will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jack.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
So the question is DNR land that's, you know, public access for hunting, and it's landlocked off of the highway. So the perimeter around that land is, you know, all owned by private parties, and the Wolf River on the other end.
So how do you get to a DNR land that's landlocked, and how do you have a chance to access it, I think is what Jack's asking here.
So if, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if the Wolf River is on the other side, Again, all public water. We have the public trust doctrine here in the state of Wisconsin. So anybody, if you can access the water, you can get anywhere you want. Even if, you know, there is a road and there's a culvert that has a stream flowing through private property into public property, so long as you keep your feet wet, you are still legal to access that area.
So stay with the streams and the rivers, basically, is what you're saying.
Yep. Oh,
Jack, thank you for calling. Joe in Sturgeon Bay, we'll go to you now. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to say how much we enjoy your program. I was really fascinated with your conversation just a few minutes ago about Knowles Nelson funding, and I wanted to say that here in Door County, the Door County Land Trust has about 10,000 acres of nature preserves that stretch from Washington Island all the way down to Brussels in the south part of Door County. And all those acres are available for hunters, whether they're waterfowl or, you know, other kinds of deer and turkey hunters. But the point of my call is that I really cannot understand the legislative situation in Madison. As one of the people said, this is one of the most popular topics. 90% of the opinion research indicates Wisconsinites are in favor, you know, of this Knowles Nelson. It's been a bipartisan thing for many, many years. And here are these guys we elect, men and women in Madison, to represent our views according to the way I understand we work. And yet this is being held up by, for some reason, 315 and 316 in the state legislature, the Assembly and the Senate, are not moving. And I would like to find somebody to go down there and kick them and get this moving. We need a touchdown, and we need it now. We don't need to wait until spring. So I wish you'd all call your legislators and tell them to get off their job and pass this.
Well, Joe, thanks for calling. Brad, a comment?
Thank you, Joe. How about that?
And, you know, as part of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association, do you guys do that sort of political thing in terms of making
we
sure?
Do.
Go ahead and talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely we do. Advocacy for the 58,000 waterfowl hunters in the state of Wisconsin is something that we're very proud of. And there's several things that we're working on right now, but Knowles Nelson is certainly one of them. And we just sent out an email to our constituents just this past week and urged them to contact their local legislators to do whatever they could to get this thing passed well before the springtime. So this is coming to a head here in the next couple weeks. So I would say, reiterate what Joe said, please call your local legislator and tell them you are in support of the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund.
Yeah. Taylor, anything to add?
Yeah, from a state perspective, I'm just going to let Brad and our other conservation groups carry that load for us.
Yeah, that's kind of what I figured, but I thought I'd ask anyway. Understood. Some other questions relating to the hunt itself from some emailers. And you mentioned a couple of things in passing, Brad. You mentioned decoys. How important are these for the hunt? And maybe how have decoys changed over the years?
Well, Larry, I know you're a collector of some decoys, so you could probably talk a little bit about just the art of the old wooden decoys. And when I say old, I mean there's actually people right now still doing that. It is an art to create those, carve those wooden decoys, hand paint them, and they're actually using them in their spreads to attract birds. However, you can go the modern route and get some very realistic-looking decoys. And one of the things we talked about was identification before. You can look at your decoys and learn identification just from decoys alone. But the really nice thing about decoys and realistic decoys is they do allow you to get those birds in closer so you can better identify them before pulling the trigger.
Yeah, I probably have maybe 50 duck and goose decoys that I have what my daughter calls the man cave, where they're all spread. They're on a platform along the top edge of the room, and they're all lined up all the way around the room. It's kind of fun to have those old wooden decoys, and there's some really good carvers out there who do a good job. What about placement? How do you make them? How do you make it so that the ducks or the geese are going to come and take a closer look?
Well, that's an excellent question. And just to start out, I can tell you that I'm literally standing on a wheat prairie in Saskatchewan right now while we're doing this interview. We have our decoys up out in front of us, and what we have them set up in is a U shape in front of our blind. And so this is to hopefully get those birds to come to land into the middle of that U. Various different ways you can hook, you can set up a waterfowl spread. A lot of people who do water hunting like to put out a V, or they like to put out a J. Everybody does it differently, but what you want to do is be able to try and suck those birds in as close to possible to make that identification and make a good clean kill.
Yeah, and there's what about arranging them on the water?
Pretty much the same type of deal that as you do on land. The J hook is something that a lot of waterfowl hunters use on the water, as well as that V.
Yeah. I've seen that many a time. Do you use a dog when you hunt?
Absolutely. You know, I think a big part of the hunt, and a big part of waterfowl hunting is actually not harvesting the birds. I would say that's a bonus. It's, you know, it's the beautiful scenery like I'm looking at right now, but it's also the camaraderie, the socialism, or the social aspect of waterfowl hunting. And dogs bring such a big part to the hunt. Whether they're sitting in the blind with you, whether they're retrieving the birds, whether they're snuggled up in the corner taking a nap because they had a hard morning. And the other thing is, those dogs, 60 days out of the year, if they're lucky, are hunting. The rest of the year, they're just a great, wonderful family pet.
Yeah. Taylor, do you use a dog as well when you have the chance?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I got a black lab that's trying to make a bunch of racket in the house right now. So, no, yeah, it's, as Brad said there, seeing a dog retrieve a bird after you spent hours training that dog, there is no better feeling in the world than knowing that all of the hard work that both you and the dog put in worked out in the end.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing is when you do manage to drop a bird, and let's say you're hunting on the water, the dog becomes critical.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Because the dog will just jump right out there and go and swim out and get the bird and bring it back to you. And that's kind of the interesting part of it, too. Somebody else wondered about bird calling. How critical is it for luring a bird in? I'm pretty good at turkey calling, but ducks could use a little help, I think.
I would comment that a great caller is amazing, and a bad caller is a detriment. So again, just keep it in your pocket if you're not very good. Just keep it. But if you have a really good caller, they can really bring birds in. And I mean, in terms of using new technology, if you're not a very good caller, there are thousands of videos on YouTube to make you a good caller. And then just put a duck call in your car or your truck with you and practice. No one can judge you while you're driving down the road, except maybe somebody watching you in the next lane. But it's a good way to practice.
And Brad,
I would say sometimes less is more.
Yep.
Yeah. That's that comes with turkeys too. Sometimes for sure. Well, you mentioned blinds earlier, and someone else wondered why you need blinds. How good do the birds actually see? What's their eyesight like?
Well, I'm not going to get into the biological aspect of birds' eyesight. I can tell you they can see you pretty darn well. But for the most part, a blind is really going to be there to eliminate as much movement as possible. Duck hunters moving is the worst thing out there, and a blind can cover up a lot of movement.
Yeah. Taylor?
Yeah, I would argue that the blind and, you know, your placement of it is the most important thing for your success. Whether you have decoys out, whether you're going to call, if you're in a spot that they want to be and your blind placement is good and they don't see you, you're good to go. You could be in the spot that they want to be and have a terrible blind and have all the decoys in the world and have one of the best decoy call or duck callers in the world, but if they see you, they're not coming in. So making sure where that blind is and that it's in good shape is critical.
Brad, you're likely to be cooking some birds, perhaps even tonight. What are tips on how to go about it?
You know what? I'm going to tell people to go out on a limb and try something different whenever they have the opportunity. One of the things that most people do with the waterfowl is overcook them. Waterfowl can be eaten just like a really good steak as medium rare. And it's absolutely delicious. It's moist. It's tender. You can't beat it. You can also use it for a lot of different things. Last weekend, we made goose egg roll. Absolutely delicious. The week before, we made a goose meatloaf. Think outside the box. Try something different and have fun with it.
Yeah, that sounds good. Taylor, comments from you?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of putting it in soup. I do a duck wild rice soup or things along those lines where you can cut it up, and for people that may not necessarily like wild game, you know, finding some ways to utilize it while still maybe hiding it a little bit, whether it's in chili or whether it's in gumbo or things along those lines, tend to be the go-to in my family.
Michael had emailed us the common gallinules.
Gallinules,
that's the proper way to pronounce it, are flagged as a rare species. The last time he checked the hunting regs, the bag limit was pretty high at 20. It seems like there's a disconnect between the two, Taylor. How do you arrive at the bag limit for the uncommon from that bird?
Yeah, so again, the bag limits are set at a federal level. Gallinules are much more prevalent in the southern end of the flyway. So again, recognizing that this is set for all 14 states in the Mississippi flyway. We have it on our end. If somebody shoots, if 20 gallinule are shot a year in the state of Wisconsin, I would be surprised. So again, the bag limit's on there because technically that's the federal bag limit, but it's just not... they're not around or available to be harvested here in the state, so it doesn't end up being that big of a deal.
Well, I tell you what, this has been enlightening discussion for me and I think for everybody else, and I want to thank you guys both for taking the time to be with us today, and especially Brad, who's sitting out there in a duck blind in Canada. Thank you very much. You have good phone reception there, Brad.
Yep, absolutely. It's, I made it a point to set up in a spot this morning where we'd be able to talk. So.
Okay. Brad Idle is executive director of the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association. Taylor, thank you so much for taking time to be with us as well. Appreciate it very much.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Taylor Finger is a game bird ecologist with the Wisconsin DNR. Great to have both of them with us. And we're going to move our attention to the waters of Wisconsin coming up next and talk about paddling. A couple of guests for you, Darren Bush and Timothy Bauer, will be with us right after this look at the news. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.